podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT evening format. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is July 8th. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Martinez. Thanks for joining us. Hope your week's getting off to a great start. Later in today's show, we'll learn about LA's glut of so-called mega mansions, complete with shark tanks, candy rooms, even classic car collections. That's coming up in about 45 minutes. But first, LA schools. Now, tomorrow, voters within the LA Unified School District will vote on Measure EE. It's a parcel tax, and if approved, the district says it would create a new funding stream for LAUSD schools, money that would go toward maintaining lower classroom sizes and also hiring more teachers. The measure is a result of the historic teacher strike earlier this year, but not everyone supports it. KPCC education reporter Kyle Soakes is here to break it all down. Hello, Kyle.
Hello, Wade.
All right, give us a little more context on Measure EE. How did it become the solution after the strike?
Well, you got to remember how it ended. It was essentially Mayor Eric Garcetti pulling the teachers union and the school district's leadership into a room and basically saying to the district, look, we understand that you say that we don't have the money to pay for all of these things that the teachers union is asking for. At least that's what the district was saying at the time. We can't afford these lower class sizes much as we would want them. We can't afford to hire more nurses and counselors and social workers and other support staffers because the district's finances are too tight. The teachers union disagreed with that. And the mayor essentially came in and said, maybe that's true, but we need you to commit to spend on this, take a little bit of a leap of faith, lower class sizes, and trust that the money is going to materialize to pay for it later. And in exchange for sort of brokering a compromise based on this leap of faith, the mayor said he was going to get behind a new revenue-generating campaign to try and make more money for the LA Unified School District. And out of that, we got Measure EE, this proposed parcel tax that would charge property owners money to create this new revenue stream for the district.
All right, so tell us about the parcel tax. What would I pay as a homeowner?
It's like a property tax, except it's not charged based on the value of your home. In fact, a lot of them are just charged as flat fees, $200 per parcel or whatever. LAUSD's Measure EE is a little bit different than just a flat fee. It's charged per square foot. So if you have, say, 1,000 square feet in your house, that's $160 per year that you would pay into this parcel tax.
All right. Now, what about if you're renting? How does it affect you if you're renting?
Well, so if you're in a rent-controlled building, Measure EE, this parcel tax, would not give your landlord any excuse to go beyond what they can already do for your rent increase every year. 3-5%, it depends on how much they're paying in utilities. But they're generally capped at somewhere between 3-5% annual increases in rent. If you're not in a rent-controlled building, it is possible that your landlord might be able to pass along the cost to you.
Now, the tax is a 16 cents per square foot of improvements on your property. What constitutes an improvement?
Okay, so basically, this has kind of become an element of controversy as related to this. So an improvement, according to the district, is just like your house. It doesn't include your pool or your garage or your gazebo. Now, the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, this anti-tax organization, has actually sued over this, saying that the school district approved a last-minute change to the legalese of Measure EE without a vote of the school board that significantly broadened the types of property that would be considered an improvement to the property. So it might include your garage or your pool or other structures. It's the wording in the language is all structures affixed to the land. Now, the school district says that the lawsuit is meritless. The county assessor actually says that it's very unrealistic to expect that anything other than just the main residence would be subject to this tax. But the lawsuit here is this cloud that's sort of hanging over Measure EE because this anti-tax group, the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, wants to have the entire parcel tax thrown out. And their lawsuit doesn't even get heard until Thursday, which is after the ballot counting is done. So what counts as square footage is an element of controversy in this.
All right. So you mentioned Howard Jarvis, and that gets us into groups that don't think this parcel tax is a good idea. Lay out the arguments against Measure EE.
Well, essentially, the argument is that LAUSD would not be good stewards of the money. That's what local business groups like the LA Chamber of Commerce, the LA County BizFed, as the organization is known, they've come out against this measure, saying that they don't feel that LAUSD is enough to get its own internal costs under control. Remember, this is a school district that has, you know, declining enrollment and huge costs for things like health care and pensions and other benefits that are sort of have been rising over recent years. And these critics of Measure EE say that the district needs to do more in order to keep its internal costs under control.
Now, the district says the money raised will go to what parents want: fewer kids in the classrooms, more teachers. Kyle, is that how the money would really be spent?
Well, so I think that this is the element of disagreement here. I mean, clearly, the school district put it in the contract. They made a deal with the teachers. They are contractually obligated to provide lower class sizes. That costs a lot of money. In fact, it costs $228 million starting in the year 2021 that they don't have the money to pay for yet. And so there are bills that are coming due that Measure EE dollars would go a long way to help fulfill those obligations. You know, more support staff and nurses and counselors in classrooms, those are also part of the teachers' union contract. And so the district is obligated currently to pay for those, and they need this money to do it. Now, on the other hand, the opponents sort of say, wait a minute, you have been saying, you, the district, have been saying that you have a $600 million operating deficit in the coming year. It's a little less than that, but about $600 million. And you propose to raise $500 million estimated through this parcel tax, and you're trying to tell us that it would go to class sizes? What about this operating deficit? Now, the truth is that it's all general fund dollars. It's all kind of fungible money that gets thrown into the same pot. So both sides have a little bit of a point here. Both sides are pointing out that there are a lot of bills and financial obligations facing the district. But the truth is that this money is going to go to pay for a little bit of all of it because it goes into the general fund.
Nope. All right. What if Measure EE fails? What happens?
So there are a lot of options that the district still has. I think it's important to say that the district still has about $1.8 billion in cash right now. That's what it projects to close out the fiscal year with. So if it fails, it's not like the district is running out of money tomorrow. One of the options that is being looked at, in fact, many of the same supporters of Measure EE are looking ahead to November of 2020 when they are trying to repeal part of Prop 13, which is, of course, that famous 1978 ballot measure that limited the ability of local governments to collect property taxes, and the so-called split roll measure that's going to be on the ballot in November 2020 would roll back some of those Prop 13 protections for commercial properties and would theoretically generate a lot of money for the school district. And so a lot of people are looking ahead to that. In fact, I think this is sort of being run. The Measure EE campaign is being looked at as kind of a dry run for that split roll campaign coming up 2 years from now. So that's another possibility if Measure EE fails for the district to potentially realize a new source of revenue.
Kyle Stokes is KPCC's education reporter. You can read about all this at laist.com. That's laist.com. Kyle, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Staying with education, about 30% of LA Community College kids struggle to pay for transportation. And more than 20% say they've had to miss or stop attending classes due to the cost or lack of access to a reliable ride. That's according to research provided by the LA Mayor's Office. So today, Mayor Eric Garcetti announced a program to provide free Dash buses to all LA Community College and LA Unified School District students. The goal of the one-year pilot program is to increase student ridership and therefore improve student attendance and grades. Here's the mayor exemplifying the need for the program at a press conference this morning.
If you're a junior in high school and you're saving up to pay your way through college, and you get offered a good-paying job 6 miles away from your parents' house, today you might have to turn it down, because there's no way you'll be able to make that trek every week on foot.
The LA Department of Transportation estimates that free Dash passes will increase student ridership by 10% and encourage young people to make a lifelong habit of public transit. Dash operates in downtown LA and 27 additional neighborhoods throughout the city. But will kids actually hop on and use the bus? Well, we'll have to wait and see on that. The pilot program kicks off in the coming school year starting this August. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Can someone cast a shadow over a place that they are nowhere near? That was one of the existential questions that loomed over the California Democratic Party convention this past weekend in San Francisco, along with the idea that early frontrunners could be losing their home field advantage and that perception may not match reality when votes roll in. Politico's California Playbook reporter Carla Marinucci was there, and now she's here talking to us about what went down. Hello, Carla.
Hey, good to be with you.
All right, first things first, the new leader of the California Democratic Party is Rusty Hicks. Tell us about Rusty Hicks.
Yeah, I mean, Rusty Hicks' overwhelming victory was really the big surprise coming out of the convention, which is dominated by these far-left progressive Democrats, the most activist people in the party. And he's not the guy many would have predicted for the job, you know? I mean, he's this quiet, soft-spoken Texas native. He's white, 39. He's an Afghanistan war veteran. He's also the Los Angeles County Federation of Labor's, you know, political director. He's been a guy who many have seen as an establishment candidate. He's got the backing of a slew of, you know, statewide office holders, many of the major unions. He had the California legislators, the members of Congress behind him. A lot of people thought he was a healer. He's the guy who could do the important jobs of the chair again, which means raising money and electing candidates, both centrist and progressive, in the big cycle ahead. And, you know, his opponent, Kimberly Ellis, was an African-American activist from the East Bay. She was kind of a progressive darling. It really looked like she had a strong organization there, that sea of pink signs and T-shirts. So, and it was impressive. And so the outcome of this election and the size of Hicks' win was really a surprise to us.
Well, so that's why, the progressive perception versus the political reality, because I got to say, for a group that's been painted as moving more to the left and more to the left, is this, dare I say, a safe move for the California Dems?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. I think, you know, the election clearly suggested maybe Democrats are looking more to the center when they're looking at the strategy to beat Donald Trump, because Rusty Hicks defeated Kimberly Ellis by more than 20 points, and that was telling because she had the backing of Bernie Sanders and his whole Our Revolution organization, so it wasn't really a particularly good sign for him either. I think many Democrats I talked to were concerned about whether she would give enough support or attention to endangered centrist Democrats in the coming election cycle. She has supported publicly financed elections, and some folks said, would that mean she would try to limit corporate donors or ban them altogether in a party where money is big and there's an ATM? That was clearly a concern, and Hicks was seen, I guess, by many as sort of a steady hand at the tiller of the job. And this is a critical job for Democrats, raising millions of dollars, helping out candidates in the biggest state party organization in the country.
Now, Carla, I was following your convention tweets at C. Marinucci, and it seemed like Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, even Pete Buttigieg got a lot more California love than Kamala Harris, the home state senator. She also fought back a bit on claims she's been playing things a little too safe. Carla, what kind of a weekend did Kamala Harris have?
You know, I think overall she had a really good weekend, but I think, you know, Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker had an advantage in the sense of the newness factor. Delegates were excited to see them. And in style, they kind of ramp it up. Kamala Harris has charisma. That's no doubt about that. But the fact is, Warren and Booker really ramp up the energy factor. I saw Elizabeth Warren in Oakland. She did a big rally there. And she almost danced on the stage. She came out and like burned it up with intensity. Even stayed almost 2 hours later to do selfies with about 2,000
people.
Everyone,
right? She promised everyone.
Yes. And there were 7,000 people there. So that kind of thing, I think, got the delegates excited in the hall. Kamala Harris had a good weekend, no doubt about it. But Harris and Booker got bigger receptions when it came to the speeches.
And I think you're right, because Warren and Booker, they haven't really been through California much. So they're new to people. And I think people want to get excited over the new thing as the flavor of the moment. Yeah. Harris lives here. Exactly. Everyone knows her. Like, okay, we know you, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So it was the new loves coming to town, and there was a little bit of a flirtation there between the delegates and those two, and I think they really did get attention and galvanize a lot of energy.
Now, to the idea of Harris being too cautious, she seemed to have a successful moment when she questioned William Barr not long ago. So how much should everyone, voters, analysts, candidates, remember that this is a long game, and it requires a lot of patience and kind of surf through the ups and downs a bit?
You know, this is more or less what Kamala Harris said in an interview with us this weekend, A, that it's a long game. She is there to get out and meet as many Democrats as she can, both, you know, here, of course, and around critical states, Iowa, South Carolina. She's mentioned that she's done a number of town halls, like in MSNBC recently, where she got one of the highest ratings in the history of candidates. So I think Kamala Harris's campaign is saying this weekend was good, but the fact is she's got this long ball approach, and they don't seem worried at all with the fact that there's a lot of competition out there, and they are convinced that she's going to end up in the top tier when this is all through.
Now, while this was happening here, Joe Biden was in Ohio speaking at a human rights campaign dinner. Carla, how visible was Biden's 2,400-mile-long shadow at the convention?
You know, a lot of people said, well, it was good that Biden had that event in Ohio because, you know, this crowd was not particularly his crowd, as we said, super leftist and activist mostly. All Joe Biden would have needed was one shot of him at the podium getting booed, and that shot would have been used by Fox News from here to next March, probably. They knew that this really wasn't his crowd. There were some people that groused about him being not on the podium, but I think most the Democrats were told that he's coming back. He'll be here in November when they meet in Long Beach, and I think most people know him in California and weren't too worried about his non-presence in San Francisco this weekend.
Before we wrap it up really quick, it's almost like he's running in a vacuum so far, right?
Yeah, at least in California. I mean, you're absolutely right. He's being very, very cautious. He's doing very, very planned events. He's not making himself very accessible to the media, but he's the front runner. And so already he's got to protect that lead. However, we have heard he's going to be in California soon. And if he is, he'll have the stage all to himself then.
Now, putting a bow on the weekend with the primary earlier next year than it's ever been, do California Democrats seem to have a sense of unity in terms of what they want to do and how they want to do it?
Unity? Are we talking unity, Dem? I mean, A, with the Democratic Party, you know, a lot of Democrats will reprise that old saying, I'm not a member of an organized political party. I'm a Democrat. That's sort of how it came out of it. I think a lot of Democrats this weekend, they were wearing multiple buttons of different candidates. They were grabbing multiple signs of different candidates. A lot of them now are shopping around. They admit they're donating to different candidates. They want to know more in the end. But the bottom line is they all seem to have unity in one effort, and that is to get Trump off the Iron Throne come next year. There's no one dragon that's going to help them do that. Yeah. And I think they all know they're going to have to fight for it.
Spoiler alert, the dragon melted it anyway, so it didn't matter. It's Politico's Carla Marinucci wrapping up the California Democratic Convention this past weekend. Carla, thanks a lot.
Always good to be with you. Thanks.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth. An online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an information session to learn more. Classes start September. Apply by July 8th for a $1,000 scholarship at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back down with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. Amy Martinez. Renters got a rare win in Sacramento last week. A bill that would partly cap rent hikes cleared a legislative hurdle. Now, it isn't very often that tenants get far in the political process. They make up 40% of the state's population, but unlike homeowners, they just don't have a lot of pull with politicians. Here to explain why, we have Matt Levin from Cal Matters. Hi, Matt.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, last November, there was another attempt to pass statewide rent control with a ballot initiative. It lost. How badly was that defeated?
It was defeated pretty overwhelmingly. It lost by about 20 percentage points out of all the initiatives on the November ballot, which there were quite a few. It lost by the most significant margin, which took a lot of people by surprise.
Yeah, and that brings us back then to why renters don't have as much political strength as homeowners, and that's because of voting patterns. So what do the stats show on that?
Sure. So renters are more likely to be lower income, less educated, non-white, and disproportionately more foreign-born. And all of those factors are correlated with less turnout at the polls. But even controlling for those factors, just being a renter in and of itself makes you about 6 percentage points less likely to register as a voter. So there's something about not being a homeowner, just being a renter, that is correlated with not showing up at the polls.
Why is that?
So there's a couple of theories behind why. So if you're a homeowner, you're more likely to stay in the same place physically, right? If you're a renter, you're more likely to be moving around. And there's some structural barriers to voting because of that, right? You have to re-register every time you move. But there's also just the idea of being more rooted in your community. If you're a homeowner, you're there to kind of fight for your equity in your home, and there might be local and state political issues that you're mobilized or around. If you're a renter, you might consider yourself only temporarily a renter, right? You might aspire to be a homeowner someday, in which case, are you really going to get out the vote for rent control? Maybe not.
And I realize this may be painting renters with a broad brush, but
yeah,
homeowners are more likely to be invested in the outcome of elections?
Yeah. I mean, again, like you note, we don't want to paint all renters as a monolith, right? But yeah, when you talk to lawmakers up here, they will say, hey, when we do something that tries to attack, let's say, Prop 13 or some of the other benefits that homeowners get, they will be inundated with phone calls and emails from homeowners who self-identify as homeowners when they're sending an angry email, let's say. Even with all of the stresses that renters in California are currently experiencing, there's just less activity here at the state level that lawmakers have to reckon with.
Do you think politicians, Matt, would ever admit that maybe if someone does identify as a renter, that they simply do not put as much stock in their concerns or needs as they would a homeowner?
No, they would. They would never say that.
So breaking it down then, what does that mean for politicians when they come up with policies or back certain initiatives?
It means they don't have to fear a backlash from renters on votes like some of the votes we saw last week. So the interesting part of tenant legislation that was trying to get through the Capitol last week, you had Democrats from solidly blue districts in California that either did not vote or voted against tenant protections. And the interesting question then is, well, why, right? If they don't have to fear repercussions from a vengeful real estate lobby that's going to fund a Republican challenger in a competitive district, why aren't they going up on these votes? Why aren't they pushing for these tenant bills? And part of the answer is, well, they're just not that concerned with renter issues because renters aren't going to vote that much in their district.
Matt Levin, reporter for Cal Matters. Matt, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
Staying with real estate, imagine living in a house with a hidden marijuana grow room or maybe a space devoted entirely to candy. Those are some of the built-in features at LA's multi-million dollar mega mansions, many of which were built on spec and largely unsold. All right, now imagine going to a party at one of those houses hosted by a real estate staging company that's really just pulling out all the stops, hanging real Andy Warhol paintings on the walls or bringing in a live camel to greet guests. They're modern-day castles that boast all the amenities a billionaire could imagine. There's only one small problem. Buyers are not biting. Catherine Clark wrote about this Only in LA phenomenon for the Wall Street Journal. Catherine, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you very much.
Now, reading your story, Catherine, I mean, it sounds positively big baller. I mean, not only are the prices of these homes astronomical, but what developers are doing to sell them is outrageous. But before we get into all those details, tell us how many of these ultra-expensive spec homes are currently on the LA market.
Well, a lot. People kind of rushed into this market en masse in 2014, 2015. There were a couple of, you know, major deals that inspired people to think that they could replicate them. So now we have about 50 at least spec homes under construction in the Hollywood Hills, Bel Air, Beverly Hills.
Now, Catherine, I am not a billionaire, but if, say, I wanted to take a look at one of these homes, is it easy for me to look them up to take a peek?
some of them are on, you know, the multiple listing service or on Zillow or some of the websites that everyone has heard of. A lot of them are not, though, because the market for these is really slow. Brokers don't necessarily want to put those listings on Zillow because it starts the clock on how many days it's officially been on the market. So if you put your listing on Zillow and in a few months it hasn't sold, it starts to look stale. So they want to keep it off the record.
All right. So tell us then, what are some of the more elaborate homes you discovered in your reporting?
Oh my gosh, they are so crazy. So we've seen, you know, massive candy walls, huge car collections, jellyfish aquariums. We even saw one that had a 300-gallon shark tank that came with 8 sharks. And the thing that they can do to differentiate the property from the, you know, massive pack of properties they're competing with, they are thinking of it and doing it.
So a lot of people in LA love kind of going around to open houses just to kind of dream for a little bit. You go to a place that you know you can't afford, but you just want to imagine what it would be like to live there. And then you see the price and you know that you definitely can't move there. So tell us about some of the prices that we're talking about. What kind of money does it take to buy one of these places?
Well, there are a huge concentration of listings, sort of $30 million and above. So if you're in that market, you have a million things to choose from. But there is also a smaller niche compartment full of properties that are in the $100 million plus range. So things just keep going up and up and up.
Talking about LA's many unsold mega mansions with Catherine Clark, a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. Now, a lot of these homes were built in just the past few years. Catherine, who is building these homes and who are they for?
So you would imagine it's, you know, big real estate development firms. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, it's really not. We're seeing a lot of new developers coming into this market. You know, a plastic surgeon is building one, a handbag entrepreneur. These are high net worth individuals who sort of saw these huge sales in 2014 and 2015 and thought, oh, wow, someone is selling a home for $70 million in LA. Maybe I should build something on my site and sell it for a similar number. And, you know, enough people did that that it kind of got out of control.
But it sounds like, and you mentioned how they're new developers that are doing this, that this kind of venture for them would be a high risk, high reward thing. They could build a mega mansion and it just sits there. But if they sell it, I mean, that could really keep them in business for a long time.
Yeah, they are looking for the unicorn buyer. So the big deal that got this whole trend rolling in 2014 was a $70 million mansion that sold to the creator of Minecraft. And he had just sold his company for $2.5 billion. He had a lot of money in the bank. He was feeling like he wanted to make a splash. And he bought this home that was really sort of a record-setting purchase in LA. So you're looking for that kind of one needle in the haystack buyer who has a lot of money to spend, a lot of discretionary income, and wants to do something big with it.
Now, we all know real estate prices in Los Angeles have really only gone in one direction for the past decade, and that's up, up, and up. So why are these homes in particular not selling?
Well, it's not even that we're seeing fewer high-end sales. We're really not. You know, we're seeing a couple of these major $100 million deals every year. Last year, we set the record with a $110 million sale in Malibu. There is a steady stream of sales. It's just that supply is far outpacing the demand. We're seeing developers cutting their prices really dramatically. Nile Niami, that's that king that I told you about earlier, he just cut the price on one of his properties from $100 million to $59.995. So we're seeing dramatic price cuts as these developers compete for that small pool of buyers.
Then what are those developers trying to do to sell these mega mansions? Because I can imagine, Catherine, that they're selling a bit of an experience, right? I mean, a home like that probably has a name, like Wayne Manor in Batman. It's bigger than just a place to put down your stuff and lay your head at night.
Well, that's where this story gets really wild, I think. A traditional open house with finger sandwiches and, you know, cookies in the oven is not going to cut it for these properties. That property, the 59.995 property, they had a huge party at it a couple of months ago. They had a camel outside. They had actors dressed as Adam and Eve. They'd modeled the whole party after this painting, The Garden of Earthly Delights. The top floor was heaven, the middle floor was earth, and the bottom floor was hell. They had people drinking cobra-infused whiskey. It was just kind of wild.
Catherine, one last thing with this. Could there be a possibility, or are some of these developers worried about this market maybe bottoming out? If these houses just sit there and no one buys them, then what happens?
Well, that's the big question. So we're really seeing prices start to come down. People are debating whether developers are going to have to hand back the keys in some of these circumstances, or whether we will see the inventory absorbed if people get more realistic about prices. The worry is that some of these developers underwrote their properties at such a price that they can't afford to sell it for a heck of a lot less than they have it listed for. But if you got in early enough and you can cut your price really dramatically, you'll be okay.
Catherine Clark is a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. She's been speaking with us about her article on LA's many unsold mega mansions. Catherine, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.